wellness and linguistic barriers in deaf communities in Nigeria and Papua New Guinea.
Hi everyone, my name is Samantha Rarick and I'm co-presenting with Dr. Emma Asonye, who is Skyping in from Albuquerque, New Mexico. This presentation will explore some of the interactions between linguistic barriers and wellness in deaf communities in Nigeria and in Papua New Guinea.
All right, so starting on the background, on the outline, we have issues specific to deaf people and communities. And under that, we are going to be talking about linguistic barriers, so the society imposed on wellness, restricted opportunities, physical unwellness. And we're also going to be looking at the best practices for working with similar communities. And then we are going to conclude. So that's how our work, our discussion is going to go this afternoon.
Starting with a background.
All right. So,
for deaf people, thank you. For deaf people, the issues of well-being and wellness and language are closely intertwined. When deaf people don't have access to a first language, they don't have access to education. They don't have access to education even about basic health issues, which, as Dr. Asonye will explain later, can be a huge issue when it comes to physical health in Nigeria. There's also issues of stigma, which we find throughout signing communities and with deaf people around the world. This can create issues both for deaf people and for researchers interested in sign languages, which I'll talk about more about my work in Papua New Guinea. There are also factors that are unique to sign languages, which Emma will talk about now.
All right, so so far, for the past 3 years, we have been working with different deaf communities, starting from the southeast of Nigeria to the south-south of Nigeria and the southwest. Some of these we have found out in the next, can you go to the next slide, first of all? Fine. So if you look at the next slide, this is Nigeria. The color, the yellow color, is Lagos, which is one of the most populous, state in Nigeria. The red color is Abuja, the Federal State capital, and the green color is, and the green and the blue color are the southeast. The distances, you can see, imagine the distances between here and there, here and there. So these are different deaf communities scattered all over the country, but we started our work right on the green and blue, but we are right now on the red and yellow. But I am particularly going to be talking about what is going on right now on the yellow, which is Lagos. We have identified with 41 deaf communities. In Nigeria, I need to let you know that deaf communities are primarily made up of deaf schools, and these deaf schools, where you have the deaf students from mostly the age of 6 up to the age of 13, 14 in the elementary school. So some of the facts we have, you know, ascertained and have found that are peculiar to the deaf communities are, one, they are the most vulnerable because of their lack of communication with the hearing community. People tend to stay away from every deaf person they see around because they cannot communicate with them. The hearing people cannot really sign. Just like me, when I started my work, I didn't know the letter A in sign language. So since we started, we've been making improvement in trying to get more people, more hearing people to sign. But yet, because of the stigmatization, the level of stigmatization that is, you know, surrounding the deaf people, and a typical hearing person believes that a deaf person is sick, believes that the deaf people are cursed. Most of the times, people think that, I mean, they need more of a spiritual problem than the social and the communication, you know, problem that they have. So there is very low communicative competence, even in the among the deaf communities, because even the deaf people themselves do not appreciate the use of their language. The most important thing that is going on around most of them is the mentality of getting out of deafness, as in getting out of the bondage of deafness. And this is as a result of a long-term stigmatization that is being fueled by both culture and religion, and the deaf people find themselves in the middle of this. So that is kind of what is really going on amongst all the deaf communities that we have seen.
So turning to my work in Papua New Guinea, it's a much different situation, but there's still these same undertones of difficulties for deaf people, difficulties for researchers, and it all stems from stigma against deafness and this sort of projected unwellness from hearing people on to deaf people. So despite the fact that Papua New Guinea is the most linguistically diverse country in the world, with over 800 spoken languages, only 2 sign languages had been reported in this country before my research began in 2016. So this is in part, like I said, due to this stigma, and sign languages in the Pacific face unique factors of endangerment. And so researching these languages is extremely important for our typological understanding of language, and it's been extremely difficult for a variety of reasons, but language and documentation and conservation can address these issues here and in Nigeria. We're gonna address some of those later on. Briefly, this is in Chimbo Province, Sinisina Valley, which is where I uncovered the sign language that's used by, I would say, at least 2 deaf people and probably 30 hearing people.
All right, so looking at the slide before you, this is a gathering of deaf people recently. I just got back from Nigeria. So these people can be found on the yellow color on the map that you saw earlier. Lagos is the most commercial city in Nigeria. And these people are products of different deaf schools that are scattered in Nigeria, in Lagos, right? I said before, about 41 of them. There's one interesting thing that happened. When we're talking about the issues that deaf people face, and we're talking about education. These people that you are seeing here, 86% of them have only a secondary school certificate of education. And you find out that more than about 80% of them also are unemployed. And when we started analyzing what the issues are, we said, wow, there's a heavy unemployment amongst deaf people. At the time, we got a little bit confused, because the question we are asking right now is, Is it that the deaf people do not want to get job? No. Is it because they do not have the qualifications to get job, at least better job? Yes. Now why? Is it because the deaf people don't want to go to school? We don't really know. Is it because they were not enabled to go to school? Yes, also. But we found out that when we got into their midst, a whole number of them who also had the opportunities to go beyond the secondary school do not want to go to secondary school. Why? Because they believe, after all, they have not seen a motivator. They have not seen a deaf person who has gone beyond where they are. Even if they have seen, those that they have seen are just a few of them amongst them. And some of those ones that have had a certificate secondary school do not have, good employment. They're not gainfully employed. For instance, there's a man that's not among their midst in Imo State, where we started our work in the southeast. He has a master's in his career, but he is teaching in a deaf school. Until today, over 20 years, he got his master's. He's still being paid as a secondary school leaver. He's not being paid by his level of qualification in education. So all these things mix up, and to bring down the level, the motivation that of getting personally developed and educationally developed amongst the deaf people, and it continues to resonate amongst them.
So while education, work opportunities, and poverty are issues for deaf people very extensively in Nigeria. This is actually not the case in Sina Sina in Papua New Guinea. While deaf people do not have access to education at all, it's actually fairly common for people in rural communities in Papua New Guinea to have little to no education. So this is not a severely limiting factor in their lives. Also, they tend to be subsistence farmers, which again is something that's very common for people who live in rural parts of Papua New Guinea. So while these are issues that are very extensive for people, deaf people in Nigeria who live in especially rural communities, this hasn't been the case in Papua New Guinea, and that's one notable difference.
So I still want to make some comment on that slide. So if you look at the poverty, so go back to the former slide. So we recently found out that, yeah, because we have been looking at the prevalence of communication disorders generally in, you know, in families and in communities and all that. So in my work, I am looking at a broad occurrence and prevalence of communication disorder. So I'm trying to tag deafness, how, you know, the systematic way it is, you know, it prevails as compared to other communication disorders. So we have found out that deafness, you know, is highly prevalent amongst low education and low income families. So this is also one of the things, supportive ideas that is, you know, around the communities that deafness and poverty have something to do together. So if you find that up to 75% of hearing loss in children, they are avoidable, they are accidental. But due to the state of the family where this hearing loss occurs, so many families are not able to take their children to hospital when they are sick, definitely. I mean, sick to the extent of getting hearing loss, because we find out that usually it occurs through fever attack, or maybe any, say, measles or something like that. And some of these occur because a mother or a father could not take the child to the hospital immediately while the child is getting sick. And before you know it, the child gets unconscious. The next day, wakes up with hearing loss. So we are looking at what poverty or what deafness has to do with poverty or vice versa among these communities also. So that is a very important aspect of our work in Nigeria. All right, so the next slide there, which we are looking at, we're also looking at wellness and linguistic barriers. This is a huge issue. This is a huge issue in all the communities we have been working with. Yeah, up to 5% of parents and family members in all the communities that we have seen cannot sign, do not have the motivation to sign. The two pictures you are seeing came from the recent trip we had. So we had decided to go out to the communities and speak to parents and try to sensitize them on some of the ways that they can begin to acquire sign language, because the level of stigmatization is being fueled by the fact that the hearing people do not sign and are very callous about that. So if we are talking about community members, those who are not family members to the deaf people, okay, fine, I don't want to sign because after all, I do not have a deaf person. How about the family members? You find out that parents, yeah, even though they have little motivation to sign, even when you want to start the program for them, some of them will drop out, you know, on the way. So, I mean, that level, that aspect of the relationship between the deaf people and the hearing family members is a big issue for our project. And that is why we have resorted to going to communities, going to families, having sensitization programs, talking with them. This is one of the schools we visited in the recent trip. So above, you see the parents are there. And these are parents of deaf students that are down here that we were talking with. And I happened to travel with a deaf counselor from New Mexico. And one of the reasons I went with her is because she is a successful deaf person. And she was a motivator to all these students. Because if you look at the deaf adults who we saw in the former slide, many of them do not have a beyond secondary school certificate. These students that are here also, when they were interviewed, about 80% of them also do not want to go beyond secondary school. So it is like a vicious cycle that we want to break. And that is one of the hardest aspects of our project so far that we are looking at.
And unfortunately, breaking cycles of poverty and of lack of education can be especially difficult when we don't have educational materials in a language that's appropriate for deaf children or appropriate to signers. What this all kinds of ends up leading into, these issues of really stigma, is this idea of a medical model of deafness, which one assumes that deaf people have something wrong with them that can be fixed. And so what we like to interpret this as for our work is it's really a model where the society is projecting unwellness onto a people, a group of people who do not consider themselves to be unwell, and then also project this onto their language, which makes it difficult for researchers to find such languages in the first place.
So,
sorry, just a second, Emma.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so I'm going to explore this just a little bit more. Due to this long-term stigmatization, the deaf people in Nigeria, to a large extent, are still seen as cursed or unwell. They often don't have access to jobs, or when they apply for jobs, they are rejected. However, in Sinasina, it's kind of a different outcome of the stigma. People often deny the existence of deaf people in the first place. So in my work, I've been working on a spoken language in this valley for 3 years, and during my research, I was constantly asking people, do you have deaf people, do you have a sign language? And for 3 years, people constantly said, no, we don't have that, no, we don't have that. And then last year, as I was hanging out in the village, because there was nothing else going on, a deaf woman shows up, and a whole group of people who I've been asking for years start signing with this deaf woman. And so understanding that, and understanding where that comes from, has huge implications for language documentation and conservation. Another complicating factor is the terminology that we use for deaf people. In Nigeria, people who are deaf are still considered to be deaf and dumb. In Tor-Pisin, the Creole that's used in Papua New Guinea, the words long long, which means crazy or stupid, are normally used for deaf people. And so in fact, I had met this woman before, and I didn't realize she was deaf. And as she approached me, someone actually said, don't talk to that woman, she's just stupid, there's no point in talking to her. So that's something that, as researchers, we need to understand and be able to address. Turning to physical unwellness, this is really a problem in Nigeria that's not in Papua New Guinea. Also, Emma, we have 2 minutes left.
Yeah, so we are looking at different ways of looking at unwellness amongst deaf communities. And for us in Nigeria, we also started with trying to look at, because we know, kind of, we assumed that deaf people do not get enough health assistance or healthcare services, you know. So one of the things we do is, since I work with a team, is to go into deaf schools, and then we carry out free medical services. But in one of these outreaches, like the one you had a picture, we were focusing on STD. And this was particularly in a deaf school that was a residential government school. And we were like, something motivated me. I said, okay, this is what we're going to be doing. I want to find out what is really going on. Is it true or not? What I found out, I mean, what I heard. And so I had a team of medical practitioners, and we had to cancel and screen the students, the female students in this place, in this particular school. And we found out about 71% of the female students in that school were having STDs. And about 70% of them have been abused sexually. And this is a very big issue. The parents do not know. The teachers, I don't know how much they know. But the issue here is the deaf students in this school do not have anybody to talk to about this, except when they had the confidence of us that they were able to speak out. So this is another problem that we are also looking at in the deaf community, the physical unwellness, and it is present.
These are not issues that are specific to deaf people in Sinasina, but something that is found in Sinasina and in working with deaf people more broadly is that bureaucracy and bureaucratic issues, that things like the IRB automatically assume that deaf people are unwell and a vulnerable population. Mm-hmm. And this may be the case or it may not. It really depends on the situation. So this can lead to denied or delayed access to signing communities and signers. Also, as I mentioned before, finding these issues can take a long time. So the man in the top image, who is signing Karuka or White Handanis, was a man who had told me for years that no, we do not have a sign language at all. And the second man, who you can't quite see, fortunately we had used video documentation for all of our spoken language materials, and going back through them after I'd collected a Swadesh list, was able to find signs that were used as gestures. So unfortunately I can't play the whole clip, but this man was actually using bimodal simultaneous code switching at the same time. So working with these communities in light of these issues, there's some things that we can and cannot do. First, we need to understand that these issues exist and be prepared for them. And also be patient, that there is stigma at both family and community levels, and it all kind of stems from this idea that deaf people are unwell and that their languages aren't real languages or that they're deficient in some way, which is not the case. We can also make sure that we don't reinforce stigma, as we know there's oftentimes these roles of colonizers and colonized. But with deaf and hearing populations, we also have this imbalance, and we want to make sure that we don't reinforce it. Also, don't think to take things at face value. If people tell you there are no signers, there is no sign language, be patient. That's probably not the case.
And we also are dealing with the issue of linguistic genocide there, because I come from a country that was colonized by the British, and the English is an official language and language of education. So no matter what accent of English we speak, Nigerians know that they speak English. And I think this also is happening in sign language, because sign language was introduced to Nigeria by a Black American, Andrew Foster, who came as a missionary and opened some deaf schools and started teaching with the joy of signing. And so up to today, you'll be surprised to go to Nigeria, find out that the schools are still using the joy of signing. And if you meet a typical hearing signer or sign language interpreter or sign language teacher, they will tell you that they are teaching American Sign Language in Nigeria. But if you find out that you look at it between what they sign and what is signed in ASL, they are typically different. So the issue here is, even the people themselves who have embraced their language, they do not, they believe what they sign is American Sign Language. While we are looking at how to document Nigerian Sign Language, which is of a truth, which has come up a standard to the level that we can say, yes, we have sign language in Nigeria, but the people who use the language, they still believe they're using ASL. So this is also another issue, so which we're looking at as linguistic genocide and, if possible, neocolonialism.
That's definitely an issue, and really something that we can do that addresses a variety of issues is including deaf researchers as part of your project, as part of your research team. You can also include linguistic and technical skills as outcomes of documentation and conservation, and make sure that you are constantly working to establish trust within the community. We also need to, just in general, kind of to conclude, understand these issues, create materials that work for the community, especially education materials if that's appropriate. And remember that even if you aren't a sign language researcher, you can do things. Use video documentation. Record what you can, because sign language linguists are constantly on the lookout for new languages that we know very little about, which unfortunately is most sign languages. So to conclude, we just want to say that this idea of unwellness stems from hearing people. It's projected from hearing people onto deaf people and their languages. By using a community-driven approach to language documentation and conservation, we can bridge gaps between hearing and deaf cultures and work against this stigma by creating materials that are appropriate and working with deaf and signing communities. Thank you. Do you have any questions?
We have time for maybe two questions.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit more about the IRB issue?
Yeah, absolutely. So oftentimes the IRB is unwilling to allow people, or they have further questions for people who are working with deaf individuals or sign languages. They view them as a vulnerable population, much like children or minors or something like that. And while these people don't view themselves that way, oftentimes they'll have further questions or not grant exemption status.
Do you have to, do you have to say that they are, do you have to identify them as deaf people? I mean, I guess you end up doing that in the description somehow, but are there other ways to kind of get around that so that it's clear that you're talking about a culture or?
I always talk about signers and sign languages, which, because I do work with signers and sign languages, I'm obviously not going to be like, here's how to get around IRB.
Yeah.
But that is what I do, is I talk about signers and sign languages because I work with both deaf and hearing people as this is a village sign language. Excellent question. What do you?
Yeah, I think in your proposal you can talk about medical versus cultural models of deafness. And I always talk about cultural models of deafness and the fact that these people, you know, are considered themselves not as disabled or having a handicap, but they belong to a linguistic minority group according to themselves. Secondly, there's even a worse problem than dealing with deaf people, and that's videotaping. And IRB sometimes can't understand why you want to videotape, and videotaping makes people more vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And so you have to be very careful about how you're going to deal with that issue. So I run into the problem of you're videotaping these people and how do you protect it when they want to share their own sign language, so it's very problematic.
Just a comment about that. I think it is important to educate IRBs, and once they are educated, that's a long-term investment. It pays off over the years. The question that I had for you is, where do you think this contrast between the two signing communities come from? Obviously, one is urban and the other one is rural. Is that what it is, or is there more there underlying it?
My understanding of it is that it's primarily urban versus rural. However, there are major cultural differences. In this village in Papua New Guinea, people tend to live near their family members. And so this woman, although she's lived outside of the village, had come back. And so everyone that she's close to, they've established very close relationships with. And so being able to communicate effectively is very culturally important. And also multilingualism is extremely high in Papua New Guinea. And so I think that's
also totally material, right?
Yes.
I believe so. I think, again, that primarily it's an urban versus rural. Do you have anything to add to that, Emma?
Yeah, I think for me, what we're dealing with is much of stigmatization. That is really what is creating the gap between the two communities, you know. So the whole lot of stigmatization is going on between the hearing and the deaf, and of a truth, that is what really we want to tackle, and we're trying to use every multiple means we can to do that. So, I mean, it's an issue. Multilingualism is there too, like you mentioned. I mean, it's a big issue also for us.
I'm sorry, we're gonna need to. We have about 1 minute left, so maybe something really, really quick. One person.
I think Linda's right behind.
Yeah, she's been.
A lot of the same thing happening here, and it's very emotional. A lot of the same things with the stigmatism and all of the people who are using Hawaiian Sign Language, they say, no, don't use Hawaiian Sign Language, use American Sign Language. But inviting these guests as deaf roles to come and share this really helps to fight back against that stigma, and it also increases their self-esteem. So I think what you're doing is really wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you, everyone.